Welcome to the Sidearm Delivery Podcast, part of the D1 Baseball Podcast family. I'm your host, Shotgun Spratling. We're back for another episode, and this week we're heading out west to talk about the Pac-12 for the first time this season. Last episode, we talked to Maryland head coach Rob Vaughn and D1 Baseball regional reporter Patrick Ebert about the Terrapins in the Big Ten. This week, we're virtually heading to California to chat with Stanford head coach David Esker, or if you want to be more proper, the Clark and Elizabeth Nelson director of baseball, David Esker, because that's what Stanford calls their head coaches. Give them these funky names. The Cardinal opened the season as the highest ranking Pac-12 team at number 6 in our preseason rankings, but completely fell out of the top 25 after starting 9-7, taking a series loss and getting swept in their first two conference weekends. But since then, Stanford has been able to bounce back, winning 4 straight Pac-12 series, and that includes trips to Corvallis to play Oregon State and to LA to take on UCLA. It's now 21-11 overall and has risen back up the top 25 rankings to number 7, thanks to a little help from all the other teams scuffling in the last couple weeks. The Cardinal offense has been led by newcomers to the starting lineup, with sophomore Carter Graham and junior Brett Barrera making the most of their first opportunities to be regular starters, and freshman Braden Montgomery showing his dynamic ability from both sides of the plate, hitting .303 with 9 homers and 27 RBIs. On the mound, Alex Williams has been a stud at the front of the rotation with a 4-1 record at .249 ERA and more than a strikeout per inning. Lefty Quinn Matthews has really taken a step forward and has been used in a swing role as a part-time closer and a weekend starter. We'll talk to Esker about how he's been deploying Matthews, the breakout of Graham and Barrera, Montgomery's potential, big-time potential, as well as how his club has learned to play with expectations and what lessons he took away from winning a College World Series title as a player that he's implemented into his coaching, and how the Cardinal are using last year's College World Series trip and the heartbreak of that one being one pitch away, more than likely, to being in the championship series, how they're using that as motivation this year. Later, we'll talk with D1 Baseball National Analyst Mike Rooney about the Pac-12, getting his take on Stanford, as well as all the contenders at the top of the conference. We'll also discuss what impact the inaugural Pac-12 tournament will have on the conference and the bubble teams that are getting a chance to participate in that tournament. And Runes closes out the show, giving us his Pac-12 award winners so far this season. In case you're new to the show, the Sidearm Delivery Podcast is a little different than the other D1 Baseball podcast offerings. They come at you over the top with top 25 rankings, top prospects, and giving you an overview of the entire nation, while like any good sidewinder, we're coming at you from the low slot using a running two-seamer. We're diving in on the batter's hands and diving a little deeper into a specific region or conference each episode, talking with players and coaches, as well as bringing on our D1 Baseball analysts to drop some knowledge. We're now welcoming our guest, Stanford head coach David Esker, trying to get the Cardinal back to the College World Series in back-to-back seasons after ending a 12-year drought last year. Thanks for taking the time to join us, Esky.
Oh, no problem. No problem, Shotgun.
Well, let's start there with that trip to Omaha last year, which actually snapped the longest drought Stanford had had since 1982, when Mark Marquess took the Cardinal for the first of his 14 trips with him as head coach. What did it mean to you to be able to get the program back to Omaha as an alum of Stanford?
Yeah, it was a great year and a special group, and you know, it was really rewarding, because I think the one sentiment I heard from the alumni was just a thank you, right? And they were just like, "Hey, Esky, thanks for getting us back there, and thanks for representing us so well." And the kids were great, and it was a tough group, and you know, the way we got there is going through Lubbock, Texas, and a great Texas Tech team, and I think it really, really resonated with all the Stanford community that's how they want to be represented, a tough ball club, not just the smart kids or nice guys that maybe can play some good baseball, but a toughness that had a chance to be a national champion. And I think we had an opportunity. We obviously didn't win the national title, but you know, after getting through that Texas Tech regional, I literally believe we were good enough that if things fell our way, we could have been a national champion.
Yeah, how did the trip sit with you to Omaha? You know, knowing you're basically one strike away from the championship series, Vanderbilt scores those 2 runs in the ninth, and you know, basically it looked like whoever was going to win that game was going to advance the championship series with the issues that North Carolina State was having.
Yeah, we knew that. You know, actually, I think it was my assistant Tommy Nicholson had come into the coach's room just right before the coaches went to the field for the game. It was after infield, outfield. And he mentioned that he just heard, you know, from one of his colleagues that NC State was having COVID issues, and that the winner of tonight's game very likely could just walk right into the finals. And so we knew what we were playing for. And, you know, you have that one run lead going into the ninth inning with our best pitcher on the mound. And hey, I've been involved in those miracle finishes, right? I was involved in Paul Carey's grand slam in the ninth inning against Ben McDonald that led us to a national title. Sometimes you just, you can't control those endings, right? And they happen, and you like to be on the winning side of it, definitely. But I think going through that, I was really proud of my program. Just the kids would not let Brendan Beck feel like he failed us. They really rallied around him. That was a really prideful moment for me with the program.
Well, how, you know, Brendan Beck was obviously, you know, was dynamic for you last year. The progression that he made from his freshman year to becoming the pitcher that he was last year was just impressive to see and was really fun to watch. But how, you know, losing him and losing that frontline starter, and then the way things ended, how has the team used how last season ended as motivation? Or do you just completely separate it, you know, not having that ace anymore? You got to go about it a different way. You know, what do you take away from last year? What do you kind of leave in last year?
Well, I think the expectations from last year was a little different for us, right? I think last year, probably around the country, we probably caught people by surprise, but probably not ourselves. We had a extremely painfully young team the year before during the COVID season and didn't get off to a good start at all. We would have been better and much improved as the year went on, but didn't get that opportunity because of COVID. But those 365 days, I knew the players that we had in the program were going to be much improved and be the type of players that could get us to that next level and even beyond. And so a surprise to many, but with the type of player that we had, not a surprise that we would give ourselves an opportunity to really make a mark. And then this year, those expectations have been different. You know, we returned much of that lineup, and I think it's been something to deal with, something that our players, it's taken a little bit of an adjustment, and maybe a little bit the reason for kind of the slow start that we even had this year. It's just living up to those expectations when you're supposed to be better. And all signs for our players where they should have been better, right? They're better in the weight room. They're better at practice. They're better in every drill. They're a year older. They've had a little bit more success, and that doesn't make the game easier, right? And that's a hard lesson to learn, is the game doesn't just necessarily get easy because you're older and better. Still challenged, and you got a target on your back a little bit, so you're getting everyone's best. I think we have to get a little bit accustomed to that, and we're still kind of coming around, and we still have our best baseball to play, but I think our players are very motivated by having a taste of it last year, and that's what happens when you get to Omaha and you get that taste. You just kind of thirst for more, and I really appreciate that because you know, they speak about it loudly that's something that they want to feel again.
Yeah, you talked about it. You've had a couple guys with pretty lofty expectations coming into the season. Obviously, All-American Brock Jones and Drew Bowser as well struggling his second season. Neither is hitting terribly. They're basically at 275 each. They both have 5 homers, 16 RBIs, but you know, just much better production last year. But they've had some solid performances recently. What's the key to getting them locked in and producing consistently as the season progresses here at the, you know, the tail end?
I think the season's kind of taken care of that for us, right? They're getting pitched tough, but now they've been getting pitched tough for 2 months. And I think that they've, you know, the game is kind of normalizing itself a little bit, which is good. You know, it's not just big as shock where they're facing these, you know, crazy pitch sequences that are not going to back down to them or give in. And now I think they're handling those pitch sequences much better. And then, you know, when at times they back the pitcher into a corner, they're able to take advantage of a mistake. And they've just been a lot more, even just better in practice. And, you know, again, a little bit of adjustment for both of them coming off of a big year and having that target and then having to make that next adjustment. When the opponents adjust to you, right, you've got to be ready for their adjustment, and you got to be able to still perform. And I think they're coming around, which is great to see. I know Brock had a good weekend and definitely a big Sunday at UCLA, and Drew Bowser did as well. And then he had 3 more hits last night against Cal Poly, which was great to see.
You know, last year around this time, you're going through something completely unusual. You're going through a COVID pause. You came back. You told me your team still hadn't played its best baseball when you came back from that. as an experienced coach that's been through those ups and downs of a season and even, you know, the craziness of a COVID season last year, what's the key to getting your team to play its best? And I guess this also, you know, relates to Drew and to Brock as well. What's the key to getting those guys and your team as a whole to play its best baseball at the end of the season?
Yeah, you know, just kind of finding our rhythm, right? And we've been looking for it a little bit. And there's been those returnees, whether it's Cody Huff, who was our starting catcher at fourth, and Tommy Troy, a dynamic freshman, Drew Bowser, Brock Jones. Those guys just kind of finding their game. And for us, a little bit, it's just the looser they can play, the better they'll play. And I think the players around them have picked up some slack for some of their starts. And I think now that they're contributing and more comfortable, if we can get this team playing loose and free, we could make a little noise here at the end. But we got to be consistent and bring whatever game, our best game, to wherever we go. And I know we've been on the road a little bit, and we'll go to San Diego this weekend. We go to Washington the following weekend. We're going to go to Utah before the season's up. And, you know, we've been preaching about playing our brand of baseball and being able to take that on the road, wherever that is, and whoever shows up, just playing that nameless, faceless opponent. And now we're playing against the game of baseball, but we're going to play the style and the brand that we want to play. And I think we're getting closer to that. And that's exciting to see. And I think it takes a little bit of pressure off of our starting pitching, which has been so good. And I think once we get that balance, I think we'll play our best baseball.
One of the things last year when you guys did take off at the end of the season is you were waiting on those freshman pitchers to develop. You know, as the season went along, they had basically missed their entire senior year of high school ball due to COVID. Where do you feel that group of Drew Dowd, who's now in your weekend rotation, Joey Dixon, Tommy O'Rourke, Brant Panster, a couple other guys that have been key guys in your bullpen, where are they at in their development arc, I guess, with, you know, the setback that they did have that senior year?
Yeah, I think they're making steps forward for sure. I think still each one of them could still has their best baseball ahead of them, and they've showed signs of that. Brant Panster out of the bullpen has been better his last two times out. Tommy O'Rourke is kind of got stopper stuff for us, where he come into a game and get us out of a jam. And, you know, we kind of altered our pitching staff a little bit, where Quinn Matthews is going to help us at the end of the game a little bit more now. But Ryan Bruno's made a huge step forward as well. You know, another sophomore who was 95 miles an hour and, you know, closed out the ninth inning and struck out the side versus Cal Poly yesterday.
You mentioned Quinn Matthews. He's covered some of the holes for you. He's bounced back and forth, you know, doing some closing, coming back and starting, use him in a variety of roles, and he's excelled. I mean, he's 6-1 this season, two saves, 2.43 ERA, 72 strikeouts to 41 hits and 55 and two-thirds innings. Terrific numbers for a guy that struggled at the end of last season. So what has gone into the decision-making process of flip-flopping him back and forth, you know, especially when he did have those issues at the end of last year where he wasn't able to get guys out pretty consistently?
He's our most resilient pitching arm for sure. And so he gives us the chance to have a little bit of flexibility. You know, I had thought even during the course of some of his struggles that to use him in one inning stints where all his stuff could play up. You know, you don't usually have to establish three or four pitches when you're going one inning at a time, and just kind of shrink the demand that he could really shine. And then he jumped out of the box this year and was starting so well for us and developing four pitches for strikes and playing against the best competition. But when it came down to it, we just had to decide with some of our younger guys just not being able to take the reins of the end of the ball game. Like, you know, I learned this from Coach Marcus with coaching with him, is he always said that the one of your top three pitchers has to be at the end of the game. Like, you have to get stronger at the end of the game. You can't just keep, you know, handing it to someone who's not as good as what you started the game with. And so we really made the decision we were going to have to move one of our starters to the back end and give them the ball and give them the opportunity. And so Quinn was kind of the natural candidate. And it's opened up some opportunity for Ty Huber, you know, to pitch some bulks of some games as well. And he's kind of flourishing and getting better as the season goes on, which is huge for us. You know, Braden Montgomery started the season as a closer, and, you know, maybe we rushed him into that role a little bit too quick, but we backed him off and now we're starting him in midweek on Tuesdays. And if he can catch fire a little bit, that's a 95 to 97 mile an hour arm that if we can get hot at some point during the season can help us.
with Matthews? Do you know exactly what you want to do with him, or is it kind of just a wait and see? You're kind of approaching each weekend as a unique a proposition with how you use him the weekend before, how you use him, you know, as the week progresses.
That's a tough one. You know, hey, we said in general that if Friday and Saturday are there to win and it's a one run or a lead where we need a closer at the end, that we're probably going to hand it over to Quinn. And then whatever pitches he has remaining without abusing them, you know, we may use him on Sunday. And if for some reason he helps us win the first two games, we won't use him on Sunday. You know, we'll take those two and we'll just have to win it with what's left with our staff. But we plan on giving him the ball late in the game if there's a game to be won on Friday, Saturday. And then again, like I said, on Sunday, we'll use whatever pitches he has left. And if he hasn't pitched at all on Friday, Saturday, then he'll get the start on Sunday.
You mentioned Braden Montgomery, who an opposing coach recently told me is just electric. And that's in the box, on the mound. How has he made the biggest impact, and what's his potential during his time at Stanford? Because those two-way players are always kind of playing with house money for coaches with the scholarship limitations that you do have.
Yeah, you know, he's got tremendous upside both places, really. I mean, he's so natural and athletic, and he's put some swings on some balls like we haven't seen here before from somebody of that age. And, you know, you expect guys like that just to continue to get better. On the mound, like I said, he was probably one of our top performers in inter squads and practices. And God, we gave him the closer role right out of the bat. And I'm not sure that was the smartest thing to do, but he had just performed so well and touched 97, 98 miles an hour in practice. And you feel like, hey, there's a guy just come in and just stuff someone at the end of the game and close the game out. And, you know, baseball's harder than that. And you know, he's got a unique job, and you know, it's tough to be a freshman and be good at one position. He's trying to be a freshman, be good at hitting from two sides of the plate and pitch. That's a tall order, you know. So he's got a lot on his plate, and he's able to handle. He's a, you know, great temperament and charismatic kid. Always plays best when he's got a smile on his face, and just has done some big things for us. Had two of the biggest swings of the weekend when we went down to Oregon State and won two games, and they don't come around like him often, and we're lucky to have him.
You mentioned that Oregon State, you guys get a series win there. You go to UCLA, get a series win. Where do you feel like this group is at in that Pac-12 race, which, you know, looks like it's going to be super competitive till the very end? And this year, it's going to be different with a Pac-12 tournament at the end.
Yeah, it's going to go down to the wire, right? It really is, and. God, you know, all the teams are capable. There are no layups on any weekend. You know, there's just nobody that is gonna take it easy on anybody, and everybody's gonna be fighting for a place in that tournament, right? I mean, even if they're not fighting for first place, they're gonna fight for an opportunity to get into that tournament and make a run at late in the season. So the league's gonna be competitive all the way through the last weekend. We're just trying to put together as many one wins as we possibly can. We don't think ahead about winning a series or sweeping anybody. We've got to win one game as often as we possibly can and try to put our best foot forward and get guys ready for a stretch run. And we're lucky that, you know, two guys like Vincent Martinez and Tommy Troy who sprained his ankle a couple weeks ago and had to take some time off, but he's come back stronger and better than ever. Had two hits last night, hit a home run. And, you know, if you get contributions from those two guys and can add and give you a little depth, and that's really going to be a big shot in the arm going down the stretch.
And we haven't even mentioned your leading hitter, Carter Graham, a guy that's 365, 9 homers, 39 RBIs. And, you know, he was a guy that wasn't necessarily in the middle third of the lineup, but has slowly worked his way into being that guy for you this season. Where has he developed the most his second year on campus for you?
Well, you know, the thing that's just ironic is the two guys who are leading us in hitting, Carter Graham and Brett Barrera, they didn't play a lick last year, right? They didn't play at all. I had 7 returning starting players, and the two guys who are leading us hitting didn't play at all last year, which is a testament to them. And actually, you know, got me to think a little bit about what playing with those expectations really means, right? These are two guys who are just trying to stay in the lineup, and they're not trying to, you know, build on a year that they had last year or be better than they were a year ago. They're just trying to stay in the lineup, and they've come out just leading us in hitting and doing a great job. And Carter was, you know, he was always waiting in the wings a year ago. Nick Bruiser had a great year for us, and Carter was kind of that natural guy that, hey, in a year, he'll take over that position and he'll be ready for it. He played great in practice for us and kind of was knocking on the door all the time. But just, you know, with the lineup that we had a year ago, there just wasn't that opportunity for him. And he's played great. He's just a hard-nosed, tough-minded kid who really makes us a tougher lineup, just, you know, in the dugout and on the field, and loves to win, is real competitive. And Brett Barrera's had a great year and has played a lot of different roles, DH for us at the start of the year. And, you know, now he's playing second base for us and probably one of the bigger second basemen in all the country, kind of that Max Muncy, middle of the order type hitter, who's played second base for you. But he's done a great job for us.
Now, we talked about last year's run. We talked a little bit about what you're trying to do to get back there this year. But let's take it back. You were a starter on the 1987 College World Series winning Stanford team. And this is a dynamic team that had several future pros. I'm talking NFL players, MLB players, future GM Ruben Amaro. The team also had multiple coaches on the roster. You had Ed Sprague, who coached at Pacific. Paul Carey coached in the minors, along with Gonzaga's Mark Maktoff. And I asked Maktoff about this last year when we had him on the Sidearm Delivery podcast. Did Martin Marquess even have to do any coaching that year with so many future coaches on the roster?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I say this all the time, which always inspires me. There is no way that Coach Marquess looked around that locker room and said, this is the team that's going to get me that ring. There's just no way he said that, right? I mean, Ruben Amaro was an infielder that we made a left fielder his senior year. Toy Cook was a football player playing center field for us. Paul Carey was a freshman that he may have got one hit all fall, that fall. Like, he is the poster child. They're like, you do not have to have a good fall, and you may come back in January and just be ready to play. Ron Whitmire was our first baseman playing full-time for the first time, sophomore. And, you know, we had sophomore Ron Whitmire at first, sophomore Frank Carey at second, and sophomore Ed Sprague at third. And then you had a, you know, a senior shortstop who's risen from the ashes to come back and get an opportunity and take advantage of it. And then we had our catcher, Doug Robbins, who was the Olympic team catcher, but Doug was taken over for John Ramos, who was drafted as a junior the year before, and Doug had never played full-time himself. We had a great pitching staff with Jack McDowell and Lee Plemmel and Rob Watsonhour and Brian Kaiser and Jim Price, who played in the NFL as well, was a contributor on our staff. I think we had 13 guys make it to the major leagues off that team, and two that went to the NFL. Jim Price played tight end for the Rams, and Toy Cook played defensive back for the New Orleans Saints and the 49ers. Brian Johnson, who played a number of years as a catcher in the major leagues, was my backup at shortstop. So we had good players, but it really, there's no way that Coach Marquess looked in that locker room and thought before the season was that this is my team. And then, you know, Mark Maktoff, who's been coaching at Gonzaga, you know, coaching a top 10 national team at Gonzaga, has been great there for years. That was a lot of fun. It was one of those teams I thought, if I do say something about making Coach Marquess's job easier, is we were so bought in to everything we did and how hard we practiced and how hard we had to play. I don't think he had much trouble guiding us in the right direction. I think that, you know, whatever he said, we did, and we tried to make it fun for him, and it was just a great ride. And we were, you know, obviously we were building off of the shoulders of the Stanford teams on the past that had gone on and fallen a little bit short, but had gotten us there and made us brought Stanford to national prominence. And then you got guys like Jack McDowell and Ed Sprague that just success just follows them no matter where they go. And it was just a recipe and the right group to kind of break through for Stanford. And just to prove how important I was and indispensable I was, they won the next year when I wasn't even there. So they were able to do it even without me, as crazy as that sounds.
What lesson do you take away from that team where you say, you know, going into the season, that's not a team that you would look at and go, yeah, this is going to be the team to win the ring? I mean, what lesson have you taken away from that in your coaching career?
You know what? I really, in the sense that you just don't know, right? That you just don't know. It's what chemistry can do. It's what career years can do. You still have to have talent. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, one of the things which is kind of something I hold in value is just the camaraderie and the brotherhood that you have to have in that locker room to do special things. Like, there's probably no way we could have done that if we didn't have that brotherhood and that family that we had in that locker room. And, you know, those guys are my best friends. And, you know, some of those friends I'm as close to as my brother. And those guys are family to me. We stay in touch to this day. And if we hadn't talked to somebody for a period of time and we pick up a phone and talk, it's if we just pick up right where we left off, and we're bonded forever. And I try to tell, you know, our guys in our program that if we're doing it right in our program, you know, just like at my wedding, 15, 16 guys of those guys are going to be at your wedding. Somebody may be the godfather of your firstborn, and you're going to be friends for life. And I hold that value of what it means to play in a good program and to bring guys together and teach them to work together and to be part of a team.
A lot of coaches talk about culture and camaraderie in the locker room and everything, but how do you necessarily build that? Is there a key to that element? Because obviously the best teams are always the teams that are playing the hardest for each other and not just themselves.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a recipe necessarily on how you do that. It's not a math equation, and it's not something you can necessarily repeat every year with the same A, B, and C. Try to get a feel for your team, and really, really just trying to get them to know one another. And at some point, maybe be vulnerable in front of each other and let them know about what their life was like. And I think empathy that your teammates, I think there's connections on teams that they don't even know are there, whether it's from childhood or experience or just struggling with the game of baseball and trying to expose them to what their experiences are. And hopefully there's some bonds and connections there that can come out, and people can make themselves available to help the younger players or just players during, you know, through life experience or just baseball experience.
You've learned a lot of these lessons throughout your career, but what's the most important lesson you took away from Coach Mark Marquis that you were able to apply to your coaching career?
You know, one of the lessons I think he always used to teach me when I was a young coach that didn't know much, he always used to say, "Eski, you know what your problem is? You think you can out-coach the other guy." He goes, "Get good players that you don't have to coach. That'll make you a better coach." So recruiting talent and giving them some direction, you know. And I remember one time Dusty Baker said to me about hitters that being a good hitting coach is a little bit of you and a lot of them. And he says the bad hitting coach thinks it's a lot of them and a little bit of the player, right? So just trying to be a part of their journey. And not letting our ego get in the way and think we're too important. I think a little bit is, you know, trying to give them some direction, try to teach them the game in a good way, and then hopefully give them an atmosphere that they can play free and they can relax and not worry about mistakes and almost embrace some mistakes through aggressiveness, and hopefully, you know, create that culture in the locker room or help create that and bring good people together. Like I said, probably ad nauseum to my team, is my number one goal is I can deliver the same experience at Stanford that I had, which is go to a great university, play with a bunch of guys that I'll have a relationship with for the rest of my life, and hopefully consider them as part of my family.
You talk about your time at Stanford, you know, your former head coach, Mark Marquis, then your boss as an assistant, you know, we were assistant at Stanford, then your rival for 18 years when you're the head coach at Cal. What was it like in 2017 when you're taking over for Mark Marquis as he's retiring?
Well, it was unbelievable is what it was. I mean, I said never anticipated that would come true, you know, even though probably throughout my early years of coaching, you know, there was a number of alumni that used to always tease me that I was the heir apparent, right? Like, "Eski, you're gonna end up." But I really never believed that. You know, when you're at Cal for 18 years, you never really think that's your next stop. But you know, Coach Marquis was so gracious and helpful, and he's been a part of my life ever since I left Stanford. And I think every major decision I've ever made in baseball or my life, I've done it with consulting him, and to have his blessing to take the baton and the program, and him to feel like I was worthy of kind of carrying on and the legacy of Stanford and kind of moving this program forward and doing it with his blessing was probably as proud as I've ever been as being named the head coach here.
Was there any new advice that it gave you when he took over?
Yeah, good. You know, one just really, I lean on him a little bit, just with his experience. My first year, we went out to dinner before the first weekend. We're playing Fullerton, and we went out to dinner across the street to his favorite steakhouse, and he's been always just so never intrusive, never just always wants to hear what I have to say about players. And, you know, but every now and then he'll say, so, hey, it's the fifth inning and Bex doesn't got it today. Who's the first guy in? And by the end of the dinner, I have all my first 10 moves already made for the weekend. Right. But we end up sweeping that first weekend at Fullerton, and in Coach Marcus fashion, he called me the next Wednesday and he goes, hey, Eske, I'll see you tomorrow for dinner. He goes, I'm not superstitious, but let's not take any chances. And I think we had dinner every Thursday before every home series that year. And it was time that I'll just cherish that, you know, getting to spend time with him and, you know, have dinner and talk about our families and then have him just ask so the appropriate questions of about baseball and about the players that he had coached and he cared about and wanted to know what their lives were going like. And so I have a relationship I couldn't be happier to have with Coach Marquis. And to this day, I talk to him probably once or twice a week.
That's awesome to hear. But do you think you can make it 18 more years to equal the 41 years he had as a head coach? I think that's the number you're at now to just to catch up to the number he had at Sanford.
I can't even imagine that many years. And I'm going to take the same philosophy that I'm taking with the season. I'm going to try to have as many one years as I possibly can, just like we're trying to win as many one games as we can, which is add them together.
Well, you guys are off to a great start to this season. You've made to, you know, it's been a little bit up and down, but yeah, Playing really well recently. And your time at Stanford, first was a regional, then it was a super regional, then College World Series, one pitch away from the championship series. So can you guys take that next step? We'll see. We'll be following along on the path and, you know, looking forward to seeing what the Cardinal can do this season. But thanks so much for taking the time, Eske, and joining us.
No problem, Shotgun. Thank you.
That was Stanford head coach David Esker, who is a half game out of first place in the Pac-12 after opening conference play 1-5. But it seems like everyone is in the mix for the Pac-12 title right now. Five teams are within a game of first place, while the top eight are only separated by three games. It's going to be a dogfight in the second half of the Pac-12 schedule, and how it shakes out is anybody's guess. But to make some educated guesses and to talk a little bit about how things are looking, we bring in college baseball's most infectious personality, Mike Rooney. Runes, thanks for taking the time to join us.
What's up, Shoddy? Always a pleasure. And now I've got to Google the word infectious. Thank you for that.
Come on, you got to use that. You got to use that Notre Dame education over there.
Eventually.
Since we talked with David Esker, let's start with the Cardinal. They started slow in conference play, like I just mentioned. And as Eske mentioned, you know, they may have been struggling to deal with some expectations after last year. You know, there really weren't any. Does it seem like they're starting around at a form at the right time that's similar to what they did last year?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Yes, I watched a decent amount of the series with UCLA last weekend. And I thought, you know, I think very highly of UCLA, and that's at Jackie Robinson Stadium. And I thought Stanford looked really good. You know, I still don't feel like their pitching is super deep. You know, Alex Williams is a guy that can go toe to toe with anybody. You know, Quinn Matthews has actually had a really nice year, and I don't know, like, you would know better because you just talked to Eske, but, like, you know, he's in the swing row, like, they've been kind of waiting to see how to use him, and that's actually kind of smart. I what I feel like about Stanford is their position player group starting to get their legs underneath of them, and then the pitching, they're starting to figure out how do we coach through weekends with the staff that we have. And yeah, I mean, hey, Stanford's got some big wins. That Arkansas win's looking really good. You know, at Oregon State, at UCLA, I mean, Stanford's resume matches up with anybody.
Yeah, I mean, when they start 1-5 and then you still have to go to Oregon State, you still have to go to UCLA, you go, oh no, this could be big trouble. But to win both of those series and in between sweeping Arizona State, you know, they've completely turned things around and right back in this mix. And part of the reason that things are so bunched up is because of them being able to do that. But it's really interesting right now because a lot of teams are, you know, they've seen some positives, we've seen some negatives from every team. And, you know, even Oregon State, who's ranked number two, we've seen a couple flaws. They've had some injuries, but maybe things are heading the right direction. You kind of feel like most of these teams are kind of heading in the right direction right now, at least at the top. You know, Oregon, though, is one that's flying under the radar. And the Ducks are really interesting to me because we haven't really talked about them at all, it doesn't feel like. You know, we talk about Oregon State. We talk about Stanford with their potential coming into the season. You talk about UCLA and all their young guns. But we just kind of have, you know, Oregon's just flying under the radar, 25-11 right now, tied for first place, 10-5, and they've won six in a row right now. And an interesting thing, they moved the fences in last year or this year, and they're about to demolish the school's home run record. What stood out to you about the Ducks so far, and how much impact do you think the change of the fences has really made for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, Oregon used to be such a difficult place to hit that I think, Shoddy, it was becoming an issue in recruiting. You know, like coaches were really in recruits' ears about, you sure you want to go to Eugene? And, you know, their best player hits 290. You know, like, are you sure that's what you want to do? And so, I Mark Wasikowski's got a great staff. He's an elite recruiter. I think the biggest question mark about Oregon was, okay, the pitching staff. You know, they lose basically the entire rotation. Andrew Mosiello starts the year a little bit banged up. You know, Adam Mayer or Meyer, I really don't know how we say his name, but he's out for the year now. But they're making it work, and their position player group is really neat. And, you know, you look at a freshman like Jacob Walsh is doing great. Brennan Malone, the transfer from South Carolina. Drew Cowley, the transfer from Cal Poly Pomona, is getting healthy. Oregon's really interesting because, hey, they lose 3-4 at USD. They split with UCSB. They lose a series at UCLA. Hey, I think their 3-1 record against Ball State is going to really help them. Ball State's having a really nice year. Mm-hmm. So, but they still have to play Oregon State. They still have to play Arizona in a series that Arizona is going to really need. But I agree with you. I mean, Oregon, hey, for sure they're going to the postseason. And now it's a team that's back-to-back postseasons. It's not new and nerve-wracking anymore. If Oregon was a stock, Shoddy, I'd be loading up on it. They're very, very interesting. But the pitching is going to be, I think, the separator. Can they figure out the right, recipe on the mound to complement what is a very good offense?
Yeah, they've got some important guys in the bullpen that have really been getting the job done. Logan Mercado, 5-0 with a 1.96 ERA. Colby Summers at the back end. But then you got Rio Britton, Matt Dallas. Those guys both have at least 18 appearances. So those four guys have really given them the ability to shorten the game for those starters, and especially with kind of the slow start that you talked about with Mosiello. I think it's allowing them to do some different things because of those bullpen arms. And that's what's really intriguing about them is, you know, again, like I said, we haven't really talked much about them. They're number four right now in the RPI.
Yeah.
So they're definite in the you know, definite sitting pretty to host. Now, like you said, the schedule does get a little bit tougher in the back half of the Pac-12 for them. But what will it take for this team to you know, stay the course and continue? I mean, we've got some very intriguing bats in the middle of the lineup. Tanner Smith, obviously part of our D1 Players Society and a guy that I love talking to every time that I've seen Oregon. And then Anthony Hall seems like he's really developing into that prospect that we thought he could become.
Yeah, and it's, you know, again, I love what Mark Wasikowski and his staff are doing is they're just, you know, if the Lord gives you lemons, you make lemonade, that old expression, right? So they've got this dynamite offense. And if you look at their pitching stats, it's fascinating. They only have two dudes with that, you know, like, okay, Isaac Ion has the 9 starts. RJ Gordon has 5 starts. Nobody else has more than 3, if I'm looking at it right. And so it's just like, hey, we're just figuring it out. Hey, who can give us 4 or 5? They're almost doing the opener thing from the Tampa Bay Rays. But you're right. Like the bullpen has been dynamite. There's depth in the bullpen. They got a lot of options back there. And you know, with the offense that they've got, they're not asking the pitching staff to put up zeros over and over and over again. If you can hold the opponent to 5 runs, Oregon's got a chance to win. So I think it's very, you're spot on, Shoddy, in that Oregon is the team that's just kind of hiding in the weeds, but they have what it takes to do damage in the postseason.
Now, right down the road is the team that, you know, is kind of the bell cow for the Pac-12 right now as far as the national rankings and stuff. Oregon State. And they did it without two guys that expected to be in the weekend rotation. I mean, Cooper Jerpy has been outstanding so far this season. I wrote about him last week in our Golden Spikes feature. He's been fantastic. I mean, he had an off night. This is my favorite quote from that story. It's talking to Jacob Melton. He said, you know, yeah, they played USC, he went 6 innings. gave up four hits, no runs. And they, you know, they were like, he didn't really have his A stuff. And then they looked at the scoreboard when they were making the pitching change to take him out. And they're like, oh, six innings, no runs. Okay, we'll take that. That's not his A stuff. So he's been fantastic for him on Fridays, but filling it in, Jacob Kamats has been terrific for him, the freshman. But they didn't have Jacob Finnings. They didn't have Will Frisch. Now, Frisch is probably lost for the year. Finnings, though, comes back and gives them a little bit and is working his way back now. What impact does getting him back have for the Beavers as the season progresses?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the thing about Jake Finnings, Shoddy, is he's a really unique look. You know, he's 6'7". He's experienced. This is his fourth year. He's made a bunch of starts. He's never been a guy that's gone deep in games. And you were kind of wondering, is this the year? But hey, like, they don't need that, right? There's a lot of, I think what really strikes me at Oregon State is a very deep roster. You know, they've got depth in the position player group. They've got depth on the pitching staff. And I don't think Jake Finnings is like this silver bullet for them, but he just kind of adds to the depth, takes a little bit more pressure off the rest of the bullpen. And you know, you're right about Cooper Jerpy. I feel kind of guilty. I saw him early in the year in surprise, and I honestly left a little disappointed because I just felt like, hey, this kid's really talented, but he just kind of seems like the same guy. You know, really good fastball. The breaking ball is just for show. The changeup's just for show. At least they're strikes now. But, man, he has found another gear, and his numbers are just nutty. And hey, even with that, I mean, he has an elite fastball. I mean, it's 90 to 93. Hitters don't like it at all. It plays like 95 to 98. So the thing I like about Oregon State is they check every box. They've got an ace. They play great defense. It's an athletic lineup. There's left-handed hitters. There's right-handed hitters. There's star players. There's role players. You know, Travis Bazana, the freshman second baseman from Australia. I love that kid. Like, great player. So, yeah, and I'll tell you the other thing about Oregon State, Shoddy. I think what happened to them last year in the postseason really serves them well. Like, they really saw what a regional looks like. They went to Game 7. They lost to Dallas Baptist in Fort Worth. I think Oregon State is a team that goes into the postseason this year with eyes wide open, and they're very, very talented. Here's the other thing. As we're sitting here today, someone's going to have to beat them twice in Corvallis to keep them from Omaha, and we know that's really hard to do.
Yeah, definitely. You know, they get a great home atmosphere there. Jacob Melton coming back from the injury and doing what he's done so far this year, I think, has been a huge thing for them. I talked with him. You know, he spent the offseason fly fishing. You know, he didn't get a chance to get out bow hunting. He said it was the first time, and you know, as long as he can remember, basically, he didn't get to go bow hunting because he had labrum surgery. So he couldn't do that, but he could get out fly fishing. But him coming back and being in the center of that lineup has been huge for him. And then you're seeing all the pieces around him, just like you talked about. He wasn't available for the Long Beach State Series. I think he had an illness, but he comes back and you saw them be able to find ways to win in that series as well. But I thought it was something interesting when I did a Golden Spikes feature on him earlier this season. Talked to him about, you know, his approach going to the batting cages all the time. He said him and Wade Meckler just used to go all the time. And it was just them. He said now he has to fight people basically for time in the batting cages. He said the culture is just so much better this year, and everyone seems to be bought in than it was even last year. So I thought that was really interesting, you know, because they were great last year and had a ton of talent, and just they ran out of gas in that regional final, especially with Cooper Jerpy, you know, not being a guy that they can consistently count on at the back half of the season. I think that this year they're ready to take that next step forward. And we've seen that they're finding ways to win even when they don't have a star player, whether it be Melton out last weekend or whether it be those two pitchers, which makes me really intrigued about what this team can actually do this year.
Yeah, I think, again, everything you just said, and, you know, the story you just told about Jacob Melton there, you know, and first of all, Wade Meckler is so funny. Like, he's like their Lenny Dykstra, like, big attitude, free swinger who still ends up taking walks. Like, Wade Meckler is the guy that thinks he's way better than he is, and you know what? That's awesome. Like, that is a high compliment. Like, he just plays with great presence, and I think he really sets a tone for them. But, you know, I think one of the reasons why, you know, what Jacob Melton described is, hey, you got to be good to play at Oregon State right now. You know, they have five guys that play every day. You throw Garrett Forster in there, you know, Justin Boyd. But other than that, like, you got to fight to get on the field at Oregon State. It's kind of what Tennessee has going on a little bit too, where it helps the coach when the inherent competition in your program takes care of a lot of things for you. You know, like, you don't have to live with stuff. because there's a really good player who's chomping at the bit to get on the field. Or the depth of Oregon State's roster really stands out to me.
Yeah, they got Finnings back on the offensive side. They also got TJ Wheeler back, which was great to see. Obviously, he had a weird accidental, you know, ball hits him in the eye in the batting cage. He's behind the L screen and has basically a hole in his eye, which is just a crazy story. But to see him back and, you know, getting back in that Long Beach State series was great to see. But some bad injury news, not for Oregon State, but for UCLA. You see the pitchers coming back for Oregon State. UCLA loses Thatcher Hurd to basically a broken back after he'd been lights out this season. He allowed 4 earned runs in 34 innings, 6 starts, 9 appearances total. Do they have enough pitching now? Does UCLA have enough pitching? You know, they always have a ton of arms, but how concerned are you with, you know, the youth of those arms after losing a guy like Thatcher Hurd?
Yeah, you know, they did get Alonzo Treadwell back, and that really helps. But, you know, the Thatcher Hurd thing stinks because I got a chance to talk to Chip Hale a few weeks ago, Shoddy, and he just said, Thatcher Hurd, dude. Like, he's like, that's what it looks like in the big leagues. And I also got a chance to talk to John Savage earlier in the year. And, you know how Coach Savage is. He basically said this. I'm paraphrasing. This is Mike Rooney interpreting John Savage. This is not a quote. But he said, I'm not saying Gage Jump and Thatcher Hurd are Cole and Bauer. And then he kind of stopped talking. And the way I interpreted that is basically that John Savage was saying, but I'm not saying they're not them either, right? Like, and that's the thing. That's what's such a heartbreaker is Gage Jump is just starting to get going. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so maybe that helps with Thatcher Hurd, but Gage Jump and Thatcher Hurd are big league arms. And so I actually really like UCLA's pitching. I think they're going to be just fine, even though Thatcher Hurd is a separator. You know, the question becomes offensively, is there going to be enough there? You know, who are they going to play in the postseason? You know, I think the one thing about the youth, Shoddy, is you don't know how are they going to react in the postseason. You know, what's a regional going to look like for them? They're probably, it's hard. I'm hard pressed to believe they're going to host a regional. So this very young team is going to go on the road. What kind of environment is that going to be? But I'm telling you, this core, this young core UCLA has, and this is the position players and the pitchers, this has got Omaha and do damage in Omaha written all over it. Now, is that this year or next year or when they're juniors and draft eligible? I don't know. But man, like the more I've watched UCLA, the only nitpick is that they're young. Like these are dudes. Like these are good, good players. And I'm really curious to see what their highest highs are going to look like.
Yeah, it's a very intriguing group, and I thought it was very interesting the pieces that John Savage brought in this offseason to go with those freshmen. Speaking of Jake Palmer and Kenny Oyama, the two grad transfers, because John Savage does not take transfers. He barely takes any junior college transfers. He loves to build guys up at, you know, from the high school ranks, and he does a tremendous job recruiting, so he can do that. But I thought those two guys coming in, and they've had their ups and downs. Playing Jake Palmer at first base has cost them a little bit. He's not a traditional first baseman. They're trying to make it work. They got Kyle Karros back, which gives them another option. I think that getting him back, a guy that's got some experience and, you know, has played both sides of the corners, I think is really big for them. And if they can get Michael Curiale going a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You know, he's batting, I think, 267 right now, 4 homers, 22 RBIs, had a big game the other night. But if they can get him going consistently, you know, it's actually been the young guys that have been carrying them. Cody Schreier and Daylon Reyes have both been phenomenal for them, have really kind of carried the load offensively. And, you know, Jake Palmer and Oyama are kind of doing what they do. But Curiale's got that star potential as well. And so if they can get him going, I think that makes it a little bit easier on those freshmen when you do get into the postseason. And I always say this is about the time. I always say when you get about 2/3 of the way through the season, your freshmen are either going to take off or they're going to hit the wall and they're going to be done. You know, they've either figured it out and, hey, I got this now, or I've never played this many games. This is, you know, I'm just worn down from school and everything else. It's just a lot of, you know, the workload is completely different in college. So a lot of freshmen, no one holds steady for me when it comes to freshmen at this point of the year. So we'll see which way those freshmen go. When you have that many freshmen, you know, you might see some guys, you know, go both ways, but which guys take off and how many of those guys take off and how they can hide some of those deficiencies if some guys do kind of hit the wall will be kind of the determining factor for UCLA. And like you said, doesn't look like right now that they're going to be hosting. So if they do go on the road, where do they go? Because that's always one of the big things for Pac-12 teams. When you have to go on the road, you're probably going a lot of times you're going across the country somewhere, and how do those guys react to it? So we'll see that. I think it'll be really interesting what with UCLA in particular, because of how many freshmen they have that they're counting on and how talented those freshmen are.
Yeah, and that's where Kyle Karros coming back, and you're right, Michael Curiali get going off the other night. Like those two guys, they don't need to hit 500, but they need to be a presence, right? Like they need to take some heat off of the freshmen. When you were talking, Shai, I was thinking about last year with UCLA. They get sent to Lubbock, which is not an easy assignment, but the real part of the problem was they're going to face Austin Love, North Carolina's ace. And North Carolina was kind of a one-trick pony last year. Like, they were really good when Austin Love pitched, and they were not as, not really a postseason team when he didn't. And when I saw that draw, I was like, oh, man. Like, UCLA, if they beat Austin Love, who knows what can happen in that regional. But most likely, they're going to lose to Austin Love. And can they win four straight games in Lubbock? I don't know. That feels pretty hard.
Yeah, the team that did win two straight there was Stanford, in the Super Regional, beat up on that team. They're actually tied right now. They're a half game back. UCLA is a game back. They're tied, Stanford is, with Arizona, who's a half game back. They're 26-12, 11-7 in Chip Hill's first season. What do you make of the Wildcats right now? They've had some recent struggles, but they did just go to Creighton in a midweek matchup and take two games there, which is a tough environment, obviously, in what is it now, Charles Schwab Field instead of TD Ameritrade?
Chuck Box, yeah.
Is that what we're going with?
Yeah, that's the only thing I got so far.
Can it be the Chuck Wagon, at least?
The Chuck, there you go. I don't know. It looks more like a box than a wagon, but I'm good with both.
So what about Arizona? What's intrigued you in Chip Hale's first season, and how concerned are you with, the recent struggles in Pac-12 play?
Yeah, they're just a really confusing team, Shoddy. Like, I think that's what it boils down to. Like, I love the raw materials. I love Chip Hale and his staff. I think Chip Hale was a home run hire for Arizona, even though he didn't have experience coaching in college baseball. I think he's assimilated really, really well. He's great people. I think for Arizona, they really struggled in the midweek early in the year. So these two Creighton wins that you referred to, I think, are a good sign, that maybe they're starting to figure it out. Dawson Nets, I don't know what his injury is or what his status is. The good thing is, as Dawson Nets has stopped pitching, Chandler Murphy has gotten healthy and he's back in there. So there's parts of Arizona that I like. TJ Nichols, it's a big jump from reliever to Friday night guy, but it's one of the best arms in the country. Garrett Irvin's a veteran. I love Quinn Flanagan. Holden Christian's another guy I really like in their bullpen. They've got options. The offense on the right day is incredible. I think it's conceivable that Daniel Susak's the first college position player taken in this draft. I think that's very much on the table. So there's a lot to like offensively. I will say this, though. They're hitting .286, Shoddy, and for where they play in Arizona, that's not awesome. Like, that's okay. Yeah. I would have assumed that number would be higher. The one thing for Arizona that concerns me is they're very right-handed. Outside of Chase Davis, they don't, they're going to throw a lot of right-handed bats at you. And if they run into a really good slider guy, that kind of hurt them against Texas State. Texas State's got two really good right-handed relievers. One's a sidearmer and one's a guy with a wicked right-handed breaking ball. Well, those guys cut up right-handed hitters. And so, I don't know, Arizona's going to be very interesting. It wouldn't shock me to see them in Omaha. It wouldn't shock me to see them get eliminated in a regional. I think it's kind of one of those teams with a wide range of possibilities.
Maybe it's like Jay Johnson's first team that went to Omaha, just kind of out of nowhere, making it for Arizona there. So, like you said, there's a lot of pieces, but not the consistency. A lot of strikeouts on this team, a lot of swing and miss at times. Like, I think the average is very poignant that you pointed that out because of the ballpark they play in. A lot of times there's those extra base hits in the gaps, and there's just the outfielders have to play a little bit deeper to guard against that. So there's a couple more hits there than there normally are in other parks. And there's some guys on the team that just don't have the averages that you expect from them, with the potential. A guy like Chase Davis and, even Tony Bullard is now coming back, has really struggled this season, had a really good midweek this week against Creighton. So maybe that's a positive sign for them. And then Noah Turley just has not, hit as well as they thought he would as well. So, there's some pieces there. They're very intriguing. How those come together, that I don't know what the key is for them. What do you think is the key for that group that has to perform for them to be able to make that run?
Yeah, I think I remember seeing these guys early in the season in the fall, and my overarching thought, Shoddy, was this for Arizona. I think the top of their roster can play with anybody, but if the middle to the bottom of their roster gets exposed, that's going to be problematic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing with Arizona. When the top of their roster, you know, Daniel Susak, Tanner Otremba, I would throw Mac Bingham and Nick McCleary in there too. And even Chase Davis, when you get him on the right, I mean, he's kind of a high walk, high strikeout, high power guy. He's like that three true outcome guy. But when those guys can impact the game, they're good. But when, you know, it's the rest of the group that really hasn't found great footing. So, you know, I think Tony Bullard is a real key for them. He's been a very streaky player in his career. You know, really good his first year, not so good the next year, really good last year, struggled with injury this year, because they're fielding 969 as well. And Tony Bullard is actually an elite defender when he's got his feet under, you know, when he's healthy and on a roll. You know, as big as he is, I mean, this kid's like 6'4", 215. He's got the actions of a shortstop. So I think if Tony Bullard gets healthy and gets right and gets confident, that really changes things for them. And then on the mound, you know, I don't know, can Dawson Nets, does he get healthy? What is his status? You know, TJ Nichols, this is going to be a lot more throwing than he's done in the last couple of years. You know, can he find that next gear, or does he start to tire? But if you made me pick one guy, Tony Bullard, the guy that they're used to, he's a real key for them.
Yeah, he did have a homer in the Chuck box, the Chuck wagon on Monday or Tuesday, and then he also had a big RBI hit as well the next day. So, you know, hopefully that's signs of him progressing. He's a guy that I saw in high school play. I was very intrigued by the power then. The power has showed, but the consistency is the thing that's been the key there. You know, there's an intriguing team in the Pac-12, a team you know pretty well, that's up the road from Tucson, Arizona State. Watch out for that team now. They were 9-13. You know, they really struggled in the bullpen. They had leads in a ton of games early and just could not finish off games. They've won three of their last four series. They sweep USC. The bats are really going right now with the weather heating up. What have you thought about the Sun Devils and Willie Bloomquist's first season? Where have they turned things around for you?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I'm very partial to Willie Bloomquist. I got to coach him at Arizona State, Shoddy. And I think, you know, Willie Bloomquist is one of these guys where he was a 16-year big leaguer, but he could have been CEO of a company, like really bright, really, you know, his dad was a dentist, his two sisters are dentists. Like, he comes from a family where they're just wired to succeed. And Willie just happened to choose baseball. So I think you've seen that with Arizona State, you know, where they're playing hard. They're very competitive. You know, hey, offensively, like, this is a group that can drop a 10 spot on you in a heartbeat. I mean, it's a very deep, athletic lineup. I mean, they look the part when they get in the dugout. The problem is run prevention. It's not a great defensive team. It's not a terrible defensive team, but, you know, they're limited defensively and they're really limited on the mound. And so it just puts so much pressure on their offense. And I think the challenge for Arizona, well, let me say it this way. Arizona State's got big opportunities ahead of them. You know, three games at Arizona, three games at UCLA. Hey, Utah is having a really good year. You know, then they play Oregon. So those four series, they got a game at Grand Canyon coming up in May too. So Arizona State, it's right there in front of them, Shoddy. I just don't know if the pitching is deep enough and the run prevention is good enough to complement that offense. But it is fun to see them. And I will tell you this, like, Arizona State is not at no point this year are they going to lay down. Like, those kids are going to fight to the end. I actually see Arizona State being more problematic for the Pac-12 than helpful, because I think they're just going to keep throwing, you know, they're like the very dangerous fighter that is unranked, but you do not want your defending champion scheduling a match with them, because they will throw punches. And you know, hey, Arizona State, if they qualify for the tournament, I think they could be a very fun team in the tournament where, hey, sometimes in a conference tournament, you can just score your way to the weekend. So, yeah, they're interesting. But you watch their offense, Shawnee, I'm telling you, man, their offense is fun. It's really dynamic.
Yeah, anytime you have a McLean brother in your lineup, it's going to be a positive thing for you. And they have Sean McLean, who's been doing really well. You talked about the pitching. Their best ERA right now is 4.36. Yeah. That's not usually a good sign, especially in the Pac-12, where there are a ton of teams that have some really good pitching. But that's what they've got to overcome. And like you said, they continue to fight. I saw them earlier this season against UC Irvine, and they were going through it a little bit. But great to see them kind of turning things around a little bit right now. And it could be that this is the stepping stone towards what they can do in the future, obviously. And, hey, who knows if they make a run here at the end. I mean, they've gained 30 spots in the RPI in the last 7 days to get in the top 100. Now, there's still that's a ton of work to do. But like you said, there are some opportunities. They just got to play a little bit better against the top half of the Pac-12 because, you know, Stanford, they get swept in that series. You know, they got to be able to be able to play against the top end to be able to make up those RPI to potentially make some moves. But you talked about the Pac-12 tournament, and you talked about them, you know, potentially causing some damage. Right now, like I said, there's 8 teams that are within 3 games. The bottom 3 teams, however, are all 2.5 or more games back from them. That's Washington, Washington State, USC. Who's the biggest threat in that bottom 3 to potentially make a run just to get into the Pac-12 tournament? Because once you get in the conference tournament, you know, you never know what can happen.
Yeah, you know, if you made me pick one of those 3 teams, Shadi, I would pick Washington State, just kind of recency bias. The fact that they went down to Arizona and won that series. You know, all of those teams, you know, Washington's hard to play because they've kind of got that Cal State Fullerton style and they can pitch. And, you know, USC is weird because they're 4-11 in the league, but they're 18-16 overall. They actually got off to a great start, and we know they've got talented players. I do think for USC, they're just young. You know, like they're just not ready yet. But if you made me pick one, you know, Brian Green and Washington State, it looks like they've turned a corner there. And again, that series win against Arizona really has my attention.
And what's interesting is you picked the team with the worst record in the conference. You know, they're 13-21, the only team below a 400 winning percentage. Their bats can do a lot. They have, you know, that's been the case with Brian Green for years, but a little disappointing with some of the players that when I talked to him in the fall for their fall report, that he had higher expectations for, just hadn't really got going so far. To USC, I think they're an interesting team. You know, you did mention they're young. One of their older players, Isaac Escada, you know, as their Friday starter, they're just now getting him back. They've gotten him back the last couple of weeks for kind of limited starts because he got hit with a line drive in the leg, didn't think anything of it. This is in an inner squad before the season starts. A couple of weeks later, he's suddenly limping at practice, and they check it out and said, hey, you got to go to the emergency room. Let's get this checked out. Finds out that he has an infection in his leg. He's in the hospital for over a week. So he's just now getting back. So not having him because of the fact that he can, you know, when he's full strength, can eat innings. And they've really struggled with everything in between those 3 starters and the 2 back end guys. And even Carson Lambert and Matt Keating have had some struggles in the back end. But everything in between the Tuesdays have been really rough because they just don't have the pitching depth right now. And that part of that is they have a ton of young guys. So if they get him back, maybe that helps them out a little bit. Maybe they can be a little bit more competitive. They got swept by Oregon State. They got swept last week by Arizona State. The Arizona State one probably is a killer to their chances. But if they get Escada back full strength, maybe they can make some things happen. What about Utah and Cal? Cal's a team that's been up and down. They've got Beavers, who's obviously a big star. Utah is a team that's kind of come out of nowhere for us. And then suddenly Gary Henderson gets suspended for 2 weeks. Just kind of crazy things are happening with the Utes. What have you made of those two teams in the middle of the pack right now?
Yeah, I would say I'll start with Cal, Shadi. Like, I was really, really high on Cal, and they just can't seem to get, you know, out of their own way, it feels like. You mentioned Dylan Beavers. You know, this is a top of the nation type of player. You know, like, this is 5 tools. You know, he's having a good year, not a great year. You know, I guess you'd say not a good year by his standards, but, you know, this is a kid that can hit for power. He runs. You know, he's got size. He's going to be a big draft pick. And then you got Josh White on the mound, who I actually thought would be the Pac-12 pitcher of the year. And he's been fine, but Cooper Jerpy's clearly going to be the Pac-12 pitcher of the year. That said, Cal's interesting because they're talented. They're not very deep. And so that affects Cal. But if there was a team that was going to just go on some crazy run down the stretch, I wouldn't put it past Cal. I mean, they've got some pieces there. I had them early in the year. They absolutely should have won a series at Florida State. And of course, they end up losing the series, you know, 1-run loss where Keyshawn Ogans doesn't touch home plate on a home run, just bizarre stuff. So Cal's very interesting to me, but that, you know, they've had a very disappointing season for, I think, what their expectations were. Utah is just a great story. I mean, I know Gary Henderson is suspended right now, but his track record in college baseball is so long and so rich. And, you know, I thought that was a brilliant promotion by Utah to move him up. He's got experience at Oregon State. He's got experience at Kentucky. And I didn't think Utah was capable of this year. I thought that would be something they would build to, but Matthew Sox is a great story. I believe he's a Division III transfer who, you know, has really given Utah a lot of quality innings. So they're interesting, but if you made me pick between those two teams to make a run, give me Cal. Cal's talented.
Yeah, if Cal can get Josh White and Beavers to full potential, I mean, that's game-changing. You have two guys coming from Team USA. They need to be leading the way for you. And right now, Josh White's 1-4 with a 4.99 ERA. I mean, that's just not going to cut it. You need guys like that to step up and be your dudes. And so far, that hasn't been the case. Now, they have had Joseph King has really stepped up for them in the rotation, you know, with an ERA under 3. And they've had some guys on the offensive side step up as well. So if they get those two stars back to full, you know, full strength, full potential, then maybe something does happen there. Now, both of those teams, it's kind of interesting. Both of those are still maybe within striking distance of the RPI of getting an at-large bid. You know, Utah's at 72 right now, Cal at 91, ASU at 95, USC at 99, and Washington State at 103. They're all maybe within striking distance. You had to go on a massive run, obviously, but is there one of those teams, you know, is Cal that team that you think has the best potential to make that massive run to get in potential to get an at-large bid, if not making a run through the conference tournament?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, Cal, I would lean towards, you know, the one thing about the RPI, Shoddy, is, we don't know, right? Every committee is different. But traditionally, if you look at the highest RPIs to ever get in the NCAA tournament, they're almost always on the West Coast. I mean, I feel like the committee is savvy enough that they recognize that there's an RPI issue on the West Coast. So, you know, we saw teams like UC Santa Barbara in 2016 with a 56 RPI, Washington with like a 60 RPI. So, and that was in 2018. So I think for the teams, you know, like you mentioned, Cal, Utah, Arizona State, they, if they can get themselves into the 50s, I think they've got a chance. The thing that's killing Arizona State is they really didn't do a great job in the non-conference. They just were really unsettled, you know, getting swept at home by BYU. That's a tough, you know, that's going to be tough for the committee to work past. But hey, we know what it, here's what you need to do to make a big run in RPI. You need to win games against teams with winning records and preferably do it on the road. And the good news for an Arizona State, so I would pick both those teams. I'd pick Arizona State and Cal. We mentioned the teams that Arizona State's going to play. They're playing almost nothing but teams with really good winning records. So if they get hot, those wins are all going to be very high RPI impact wins. Cal, I just think because they're of their sheer talent, you mentioned the two key players for Cal. When Cal's best players are playing their best, they can beat anybody in the league. Like Dylan Beaver starts for everybody in the Pac-12. Josh White is in the rotation for every team in the Pac-12. So those guys can do it. It's just a matter of can they get hot.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. Utah jumped up from 88 to 72 with, you know, added 16. Arizona State and USC basically, you know, Arizona State gained 30, USC lost 29, you know, the sweep that they had there. So both those teams around the same spot. So a big sweep can give you a big boost. But it becomes harder and harder to take those big jumps as you go up the ranking board there with the RPI because the other resumes are so much better. So then it might come down to who can make a run in the Pac-12 tournament. How do you think the Pac-12 tournament is going to change things for the conference and for those bubble teams? You know, just with strategy one, how do you play it out? You know, if you have a Wednesday game, you know, if you're a top seed, you're not throwing your Friday guy, but you might see a Utah or a Cal throw their Friday guy on a Wednesday trying to win a couple extra games. How do you think it's going to play out? I'm super intrigued. I'm looking forward to being in Scottsdale. It should be super fun.
Oh, so I'm so pumped that there's going to be a tournament there, Shoddy. You're going to have a blast. Scottsdale, I live in Arizona. I lived in Scottsdale for 15 years. I know it's going to be hot. It's still going to be awesome. Scottsdale at 100 degrees is still awesome. It's still super fun. So much to do there. It's a beautiful ballpark. But I would tell you that, you know, like any coach or player would say, like, hey, I just want an opportunity to put it in my own hands. Mm-hmm. And that's what a conference tournament does for these teams. You know, think about like a UCLA or an Arizona. Let's say they're in position to host. Well, they got another week to make a run and do something about it. Make another statement to the committee. We just mentioned Cal and Arizona State. Let's say they do get themselves close. Well, it gives them another opportunity to make a statement to the committee. So that's what I love about the conference tournament for the Pac-12. I think it's going to be good for fans too. Think about all these really talented players in one place where fans can go watch really good baseball. And, you know, again, for some of these kids, they're playing like it's their last game. So I'm very pro conference tournament. I know why coaches don't love them, but here's what always happens, Shadi, and you know this. Coaches always say, oh, I don't want conference tournaments. I want just a regular weekend so I can get ready for the NCAA tournament. And then the coaches get there on site and they get sucked in. And it gets, you know, it's just awesome. You know, it happens every year at the big conference tournaments. And so I think it's going to be a blast.
It's definitely should be fun. And you mentioned the star talent, the Pac-12 star talent that we've seen over the last few years. I mean, if you're just a random baseball fan, you know, you go to some spring training games and you see Adley Rutschman and Andrew Vaughn are coming into town. Hey, I'm going to go out and check them out. So I think it's a great opportunity to showcase the talent pool that is in the Pac-12, the teams that are playing and what is being done in the, you know, in the Pac-12 that kind of gets forgotten about because the Pac-12 network is not a very good television broadcast system for all these great players. So I think it's a great opportunity for teams and for players to showcase themselves. I'm really looking forward to it. Four games in a day is always exhausting, but I'm ready to do it for the betterment of the West Coast and, you know, be out there to cover all those. Should be really fun. Last thing for your Runes. Little over halfway through Pac-12 play, so not too much left. You've already mentioned Cooper Jerpy, you think is your Pac-12 pitcher of the year right now. Who's your Pac-12 player of the year then?
Yeah, player of the year is kind of fun. You know, there's some really good names, you know, like Daniel Susak, Tanner Otremba, Wade Meckler, you mentioned, Joe Lampe of Arizona State's having a killer year. You know, Travis Bazana, Jacob Melton, Jacob Walsh, the first baseman at Oregon, who's a Las Vegas kid I love. Connor Davis, one of my favorite all-time players in college baseball. But I'm going to go Daniel Susak, Shadi. You know, he leads the Pac-12 with 65 hits. That's 11 better than anybody else. His power is really coming. I really do think he might be the first position player drafted this year. Maybe Kevin Parada of Georgia Tech beats him out. But, you know, like Daniel Susak, if you're scouting, you're looking at him like, that guy for sure is catching in the big leagues if he stays healthy. Like, there's no doubt in my mind. So I would give it to him. He's a prospect. He's backed it up. I think he's a longtime big leaguer.
Who would you give your freshman of the year to?
Yeah, I would go Bazana, hands down, although I love Jacob Walsh. I think he's really, really fun. By the way, Sean McClain, I didn't even make my mentions there. But, I, you know, Jacob Walsh, the left-handed hitting first baseman for Oregon, I love. But Travis Bazana is a special player. Like, he's the comp, it's a weird comp, but the comp, the player he reminds me of is Alex Bregman when he was at LSU. Now, Bregman's left side of the infield, right-handed hitter. Bazana is a left-handed hitter on the right side of the infield. But what I mean by that is they're really aggressive. Kind of they play with their face first. And they just, you know, they're really good players who are confident and aggressive. And it always feels, when I've watched Oregon State play this year, Bazana feels like he's in the middle of everything. He just is always making stuff happen. So I'm a huge fan. I think he's the freshman of the year in the league.
That doesn't include anyone from UCLA, and you know the class they have, and Thatcher Hurd would definitely be in that mix if he was healthy.
No doubt.
Again, unfortunate and very disappointing to hear that the news of that. One of the most interesting awards that's going to be given out will be Coach of the Year. I mean, this could go to anyone. I mean, it feels like there's four, five, six guys that could be in the mix. I mean, what Arizona State's doing right now, you'd even look at Willie Bloomquist. I know that's a very outside the box, but if they continue what they've done recently, you know, that could be a one you look at because of how poor they were early in the season and the fact that they don't have any pitching. But a lot of candidates, how are you going to kind of wagering that one out right now?
Yeah, I think what happens down the stretch will really kind of help us with that award. But if you made me pick it today, I mean, I think you know what Stanford has done, where they, you know, they start with a bullseye on the back, they kind of disappear and falter, and now they're back. You know, you mentioned Willie Bloomquist. I think he's done a heck of a job. Chip Hale's done a heck of a job. I think you know, John Savage with all those young kids, that's not easy standing up at a Pac-12 schedule and the schedule UCLA plays. But I would pick one of the Oregon coaches. You know, Oregon State, Mitch Canham. It really, I don't know if you feel this way, Shadi, it feels like it's his program now. Last year, it kind of felt like he was driving Pat Casey's car. Now it feels like it's his. And I would also say Mark Wasikowski. You lose those big three hitters that they lost last year. You lose your entire rotation. And here you go again, right in the mix to host and win the league. That's really impressive. That would be tough because Oregon State's one of the best teams in the country, so that's a nod to Mitch Canham. But for Oregon, for what they lost, to have a program lose three core hitters in the middle and your entire rotation and be right back at the top of the standings, that's hard to walk away from.
Well, it'd be intriguing to see who wins the awards at the end of the year because there are candidates in pretty much all of them. Cooper Jerpy definitely out in front on that one, but definitely a lot of candidates for the other one. So who does well the last month of the season could determine that. And the Pac-12 race is going to be fantastic, I think, with, you know, like we said, five teams within a game. It's eight teams within three games and three teams at the bottom trying to fight to get in that top eight. And I thought that was an interesting comment. I talked with Dave Esker after the recording and talking about the Pac-12 tournament. He said no one's going to be easy leading up to the Pac-12 tournament because you have those teams at the bottom. They're just fighting to try to get in. And maybe those teams are lying down in the past a little bit and playing some young guys or whatever it may be. But they're fighting to get into that conference tournament. So that makes it even more intriguing. Should be really fascinating. And I know, Runes, you're going to be watching as many games as possible. We are too. And we appreciate you taking the time to talk a little Pac-12 baseball with us.
You got it, Shoddy. Always a pleasure.
That's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Sidearm Delivery Podcast. That was D1 Baseball National Analyst Mike Rooney. Thanks again to him for jumping on to talk about the Pac-12. Thanks as well to Stanford head coach David Esker for taking the time to join us. And thanks to also to you guys for listening. Please like, subscribe, leave a five-star review, all those fun things. And let me know on Twitter your favorite part and who you want to see us have on the show next. Hope you enjoyed the podcast and hope you'll be back for the next episode of D1 Baseball's Sidearm Delivery Podcast, hosted by yours truly, Shotgun Spratling. Ding, ding.